Hi, I'm Joshua Noeg. I'm a professor of philosophy at UNC.
And I'm Laura Sanchez. I'm a professor of psychology at Yale University.
And today we're going to be talking about some new research about monkeys and chimpanzees. So people have been doing research on monkeys and chimpanzees trying to use this as a tool to understand the human mind for decades. But it seems like you've recently been taking this kind of research in a new direction.
Yeah, we've done a lot of the same stuff that you were just talking about too, trying to look at, you know, how humans and monkeys are similar for a lot of the cognitive capacities that, you know, people really care about and sort of hold dear to their hearts. But lately we've been switching a little bit and actually looking at the cognitive capacities that we might not be so proud of.
Mm-hmm.
So part of that is just trying to, you know, if you look across human cognition, there's all this stuff that we'd like to think are unique because we, you know, we're really proud of it, you know, so things like our ability to reason about other minds and our sense of self and language and tool use and all that stuff. But, you know, of course, psychologists have identified, you know, now for decades, all these cognitive abilities that we're not so proud of. You know, we stereotype, you know, we systematically decide things incorrectly, or we systematically get math problems wrong and so on. And to date, nobody's really looked at that in non-human animals, so that was kind of where we come in.
So earlier research tried to test whether monkeys were as smart as humans, and you're trying to test whether monkeys are as dumb as humans.
Yes, which might sound like kind of a moot point, but there's this really big question about where our dumb human capacities come from. Because, you know, the smart capacities, we could learn that. You know, we could learn that through reinforcement or through teaching or through culture and so on, but these errors are a little bit more puzzling because, you know, where do they come from? And we're actually sort of coming from the hypothesis that some of those errors might be interestingly built in and possibly evolutionarily pretty old.
So you're thinking that if monkeys end up making the same errors that humans make, that would be evidence that we're actually born with an innate tendency to make those very errors.
That's kind of where we're coming from, yeah.
So far you've looked at a number of different errors, but the one I wanted to start out with first was the kind of errors that are normally associated with cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
So could you start off by telling a little bit about how this phenomenon works in humans?
Yeah, so the term cognitive dissonance, which is something that's a term that's been around since the 1950s, refers to the kind of discomfort we get when several of our cognitions come into conflict. And by cognitions here, I mean all kinds of things like our beliefs, our attitudes, our judgments, our decisions, our behavior, and so on. So take the case of I might have the belief that George Bush is a good president. I don't actually have that belief, but say in this fictitious world that I did. You know, I believe that George Bush is a good president, but I also believe that the Iraq war was a bad idea. You know, if I were to take those two cognitions into account, I would say, hey, wait a minute, these things don't actually make sense together. And I might experience some discomfort for having these cognitions together that don't make a lot of sense. And psychologists studying this phenomenon, studying this dissonance or this discomfort, have said, well, people should try to engage in activities that actually reduce their dissonance. So functionally changing one of their attitudes, so I might decide, actually, I don't think George Bush is a good president, you know, and sort of make my opinion of George Bush fit more with my opinion of the Iraq war and so on. The important thing from the perspective of why this seems like an error, why this is bad, is we probably don't want to be changing our cognition around willy-nilly, particularly in cases where, you know, some of these attitudes or decisions and so on might be random or chance or, in some studies, induced by an experimenter. So this is kind of the funny thing about dissonance, is it really involves us kind of changing our own cognitions, sometimes in this sort of willy-nilly way.
So could you give some examples of irrational ways in which people have changed their cognitions as a result of wily experimenters and atheism?
Yeah, so there's been some really classic studies in the 50s that unfortunately we probably couldn't do anymore because of, you know, potential ethical issues. But, you know, in some of the most brilliant ones, you bring subjects into the lab and you have them engage in an extremely boring task. I mean, some of these tasks where, you know, the subject has to sit there and sort of turn pegs over and over again. And then once they're done turning them one way, turn them another way, so for hours on end. And then you ask subjects, you know, how did you feel about the task? And, of course, most people thought this was a really boring experiment. So then here comes the interesting manipulation that could induce the dissonance. So now you tell them, actually, you know, this research assistant canceled on us. We need an extra person to actually go and tell the new subjects how fun and exciting the task was, because we want to convince the new subjects that the task was fun and exciting. So most participants say, okay, I'll do this. And then subjects have to go and do this, and they're either paid a large sum of money to do this, so they're given like 20 bucks, which is, you know, in the 1950s, this was pretty good, or they're only given a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is they tell the subject, you know, oh, this was a great task, I love it. And then after they do that, they're asked, how much did you actually like the task? So the people that were paid 20 bucks shouldn't really have any dissonance. If they ask, well, why did I lie to this person and tell them the task was really fun? Well, they lied because, you know, they were paid 20 bucks, which is, you know, a reasonable sum to lie.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys who were only paid a dollar, when they ask, well, why did I lie to the subject? You know, I was only paid a dollar. The idea is this should be dissonant. They don't want to be a liar for only a dollar. And the way they resolve that dissonance is actually to change their opinion of the task. So they come around and decide, actually, this extremely boring task of turning those spools around was, in fact, really fun. And I really enjoyed it. And I'd do it again, and all these things. So here's an example in which just being paid a different amount of money can actually induce subjects to change their opinion of what should standardly be considered a very, very boring task.
So if we want to get our students to really feel passionately about cognitive science,
we should pay them extremely little
extra credit as we possibly
exactly.
can, while still making them do the extra work.
Exactly. I think this is why graduate pay schedules are the way they are.
So far you've been talking about certain kinds of experimental studies on dissonance,
mm-hmm.
but how does this phenomenon actually affect sort of our day-to-day life? So what kinds of things that actually happen to us ordinarily are kind of affected by this condition?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that dissonance actually affects us all the time. You know, so anytime we engage in lots and lots of extra effort for something, the prediction is that we might, kind of ironically enough, end up liking that sort of thing more. You know, the things that hurt us the most tend to be things that we actually end up liking the most in a really funny way.
Mm-hmm.
Another important way that dissonance can affect us in our daily lives is that one of these cognitions that can change around our attitudes and so on is our decisions. So sometimes when we're forced to decide something, we sometimes decide arbitrarily, but then that decision, whichever way the decision went, can then change around our cognition later and make us like more the things that we decided, you know, to buy, or the things, you know, the people we decided to hire, or the schools we decided to go to, all this stuff.
So could you give an example of an experimental study that really tested this kind of derogation of non-chosen alternatives?
Yeah, so there was a really cool study by Jack Brehm in the 1950s that looked at this exactly. So he actually brought in 50s housewives into the lab, and he sat them down and gave them a big array of exciting objects. Turned out the objects were wedding presents that Brehm and his wife had actually received. But he told the subject, I don't know why Brehm's wife was down with this, but whatever. But he told the subjects, now you get to rate all of these household items and tell me how much you like them on, say, a 7-point scale.
Mm-hmm.
So subjects go through and they rate all the items, and then Brehm says, aha, now that you've done the ratings, you're going to get to pick and take home one of the two items. And he gives them a choice of two different items, both of which were rated correctly. So the subject said, you know, the toaster, say, was a 5, and the clock was a 5. And so now the subject has to choose between the clock and the toaster, which she,
mm-hmm.
the subject just said were the same. And the idea is that this choice should induce some dissonance, right? She just said they're the same, and now she has to pick one. So
mm-hmm.
now the subject, say, probably just picks arbitrarily, say she picks the toaster. And the question is, what happens to the object that she didn't choose? What happens to the clock in this case?
Mm-hmm.
And what you find is that if you ask the subjects to re-rate all the items, the subject's preference for the item that she didn't choose, like the clock in this case, actually goes down. So she likes the clock less than would be expected by chance, which is kind of crazy.
Okay, so if you are trying to make sure that someone likes you, what you should do is never give them a chance to arbitrarily choose someone else over you.
Exactly, or arbitrarily somehow find a way for them to choose you.
All right.
Yeah.
So if you want to have, say, a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you should try to make them suffer so that then they introduce additional cognitions in order to justify the suffering you've been experiencing in order to be with
you. Yeah, I'm worried you might be reading too much personal stuff into this, Josh. But,
okay.
But the logic works, yeah.
Okay, so far we've been talking about dissonance in human beings. But now suppose we turn over to the
mm-hmm.
question of dissonance within monkeys.
Right.
So how can you test whether monkeys also show this effect?
Well, this is always the big problem when we switch to monkeys is, you know, how do we ask the monkeys, you know, to do a rate egg or to do a choice or, you know, to turn the pegs or these kinds of things. So what we decided to do is to pick the simplest kind of cognition that we could look at in the monkeys, which is their choice. And the idea was, let's, you know, do kind of a Brehm study with the monkeys. Let's find objects that we're pretty sure they think about equally and then force them to choose between two of the objects and then try to see if they like less the object that they chose against. And, you know, because I don't have wedding presents currently and monkeys don't like them, even if I did, we went with three objects that we thought the monkeys would like equally, which turned out to be different colored M&Ms. Because, you know, like humans, monkeys like M&Ms. So what we were able to do is first give the monkeys a choice between two M&Ms, let's say the A M&M and the B M&M. And because the M&Ms aren't different flavors, they're just different colors, the presumption is that the monkeys should choose between them equally. They don't really know, so they're just going to pick. So let's say the monkey picks A. Now the idea is we take the other M&M, this B M&M that the monkeys didn't choose, and then a novel M&M, say M&M C, that, again, the monkeys should have no reason to prefer. And then we give them a subsequent choice between M&Ms B and C. And the idea is if the monkeys are showing dissonance just like in the Brehm studies, then they should derogate the B M&M, the one that they didn't choose before. And surprisingly, that's actually just what we find. So the monkeys statistically choose C, this novel M&M, over the one that they avoided before. The very cool thing is that the monkeys don't actually do this in cases where they themselves don't make a choice. So if you force the monkeys to pick one of the two M&Ms, you know, you just give them A over B, then the monkeys are they don't show the same effect. In fact, they do the opposite thing. They actually prefer the thing that you took away from them later on in the choice phase.
So if I choose the red M&M over the blue M&M to give to the monkey, the monkey will actually think that the blue M&M is better because it's the one I didn't choose to give him.
Exactly. Which is pretty smart, you know, if you're reasoning about behavior. But the cool thing is the monkeys do something that's not very smart in the case when they make a choice. They should realize, of course, that their choice is probably pretty arbitrary, but yet the arbitrary choice then affects their future preferences. You know, they may forever hold a grudge against the blue M&M, say, in that case, you know, just because they made an arbitrary decision.
So, if you were thinking now about the fact that monkeys show the very same phenomenon, the dissonance phenomenon, it seems like there are kind of two different sorts of conclusions you could draw from this in terms of what it means about human beings. So one you could draw is that it seems like whatever was at the root of the phenomenon that we originally observed in humans, it must have been something very simple, something that didn't involve very complex kinds of cognitions about the self and the value of one's own actions. Or one could draw the exact opposite conclusion and say, we must have been very mistaken about how complex the cognition of monkeys are, and that monkeys actually have very complex beliefs about themselves and about the dissonant cognitions that they're experiencing and so forth.
Yep.
So which of those two kinds of conclusions would you want to draw from this thing?
Well, right now we're not really sure. Right now we're not really sure. There's some reason to suspect that the first conclusion is the right one. In other words, we see this phenomenon in monkeys, it must be a really dumb phenomenon and not that interesting, even in humans. And one data point that goes in this direction is the fact that you can see the same kind of dissonance behavior in amnesic subjects, right? So these are subjects who, you know, have had a brain trauma, now they no longer remember their decisions. So the idea is if you don't remember your decision, how can that decision affect your choice later? Matt Lieberman, a social psychologist, and his colleagues actually brought amnesics into the lab. They made them choose between, say, A and B, and then they let the amnesic leave. Time goes by, the amnesic forgets, and then the idea is amnesics have to re-rate all the items again. And the prediction is that if the amnesics are actually experiencing dissonance, they should now dislike this object that they chose against. But remember, the amnesics can't actually remember their own choice. But what you find is, despite the fact that they can't remember their choice affects their later preferences. So the important thing about this study is it shows that whatever is going on, it has to be a really dumb phenomenon. It's a phenomenon that can't even remember your initial choices in the beginning. So on that account, it seems like what the monkeys might be doing might be something that's relatively simplistic. But on the other hand, you know, we're not really sure. I mean, one of the things that we're trying to do now, this is actually all this work, I should say, is in collaboration with my graduate student, Louisa Egan, and a developmental psychologist, Paul Bloom. And what Louisa is doing now is a lovely series of studies to try to see whether or not the monkey's dissonance is actually affected by how good they're feeling about themselves. Because in humans, what you find is that you don't really need to reduce dissonance as much when you're feeling good about yourself. So she's actually doing a study now where she's trying to affirm the monkeys and make them feel good about themselves, and trying to see if that changes around their pattern of dissonance reduction later.
Oh, so could you give an example of one of the early human studies that used this self-affirmation technique?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different ways you can do it. A really cute one is you have people say whether they feel like they're good scientists or they feel more like a humanities kind of person. And then you come in before you do the dissonance test and you have both subjects wear a scientist's lab coat. And the idea is that for the subjects who said they're scientifically minded, they're feeling really affirmed. They're like, yeah, science, I feel really good. And so they don't need to reduce dissonance as much as the other students who said that they weren't really scientifically minded. So these ideas, these really funny manipulations of how good you're feeling about yourself can actually change around the extent to which you need to reduce your own dissonance.
So you can't put the monkeys in a lab coat. So what are you going to do for the monkeys to either affirm yourself or do the opposite?
This is a good question. One we haven't exactly figured out yet, but one of the things we're going to try to do is to use the monkey's relative position in his own dominance hierarchy. So all the monkeys that we work with actually live in a hierarchy. So there's one monkey who's the alpha monkey, who's kind of the highest ranking monkey. He can eat whatever he wants and, you know, mate with whoever he wants and so on. And then it kind of goes down from there. So we're going to pick subject monkeys who are in the middle of the hierarchy and either let them hang out with the alpha male, which should make them feel pretty bad about themselves because they're way lower ranking than the alpha male, or put them inside, you know, so they get to interact with one of the lowest ranking males. So the idea is now they should feel, I'm higher ranking than that guy. Like, I feel pretty good about myself. And then try to see later how they perform on this dissonance reduction task. So the point is to try to see, you know, maybe this phenomena that we're observing in the monkeys actually is high level in the sense that it, you know, it responds to how the monkey is feeling about him or herself at the time. We don't have those results just yet, but the exciting thing is now we have a method to start looking at this cognitive dissonance phenomenon and really ask the question, you know, is this a simple mechanism or is this actually something that involves these higher level things like the self and so on, even in the monkeys?
So if you didn't get that effect, if the sort of affirmation approach didn't have any effect on the dissonance findings, then would you conclude that the monkeys are actually showing these same kind of behavioral patterns that humans are showing, but that they're somehow showing them for a different reason or as a result of a different underlying psychological process?
Yeah, that's kind of where we're going with this, is that, you know, what are the kinds of things that can affect monkeys' dissonance reduction, and are those the same kinds of things that affect humans' dissonance reduction? If we see different processes affecting the monkeys and the humans, then we might purport that, you know, well, what's going on in the monkeys is something totally different. But the exciting thing is I think that whatever happens with the monkeys, it'll actually allow us a new angle to go look at humans and say, oh, wait a minute, this is what happened with the monkeys. Let's go check and see what's going on with humans and so on.
So far we've been talking about one particular way in which human beings can be very dumb. And this is the way in which human beings show these dissonance effects. But you've also done work on another way in which human beings can be dumb, and this is loss aversion.
That's right.
So could you start out by explaining what loss aversion is?
Sure. So loss aversion is just simply a bias that we have when we're dealing with different economic gambles. So just to take a step back, we should have a really clear way that we should be going about dealing with economic gambles, and that's to kind of maximize our own payoff or maximize our utility, as an economist might say. So to an economist, you know, how you should behave and how you should decide in the world is pretty easy, because you should just behave in ways that allows you to, you know, get the most money or the most utility if you're not into all money and that so on. But it turns out that humans don't regularly behave like this. In fact, there are all kinds of situations in which humans deviate from what you might predict based on this kind of expected payoff kind of model. And these deviations were first and best documented by the behavioral economists Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who came up with all these scenarios in which people completely deviated from what an economist might predict. And of course, the economist prediction relies on the fact that, you know, we make decisions paying attention to our overall utility, our overall wealth level or something. And we, of course, don't think like that, in part just because it's hard to think like that, but also it's a really counterintuitive way for us to think. You know, so if you leave this interview right now and you go out and you find that you have a parking ticket on your car, you won't say, like, you know, rats, my entire net worth is now, you know, whatever Josh Knobe's entire, I don't want to speculate about these things. But you would probably just say, you know, rats, like $20, or, you know, now I'm out, you know, this much money. So we don't think in terms of our overall wealth level. We think in terms of sort of set reference points. In this case, your status quo, like, you know, while you were doing the interview, you were $20 up than when you went out and saw this parking ticket later. And so this reference dependence, as they called it, is this idea that we don't think in terms of the overall amount of stuff we have. We think instead in terms of slight deviations from them. And loss aversion, which is the phenomena that you brought up earlier, is the fact that not all deviations for us are the same. In fact, deviations from our status quo in the negative direction, you know, things like parking tickets, are much more upsetting to us than deviations in the positive direction are. Sort of happiness inducing for us.
So we would actually be much less willing to do a lot of work to avoid parking tickets if people framed them in the opposite way. Like, suppose the municipal government started out by just giving everyone $20.
Exactly.
Or say, taking away $20. And then they would give us back, $20 if we always parked correctly.
Exactly.
Then we'd be much less willing to park correctly than if they said, say, for example, we'll actually remove $20 from you
right.
if you park incorrectly.
Yeah, so perhaps this is why the parking ticket structure is in place. It's sort of capitalizing on our loss aversion to get people to park correctly. So yeah, I mean, there's lots of situations in which you see this kind of loss aversion phenomena. One that economists talk about all the time is the fact that people don't invest as much in stocks as they should, and they tend to invest in bonds even more. And the reason for this is that, you know, stocks are more variable. They, you know, sometimes you're in the red, but a lot of times you're doing pretty well. But because of the variable nature of stocks, often you're seeing your portfolio and you get a loss. But overall, you're doing better, but you get more losses than you would with bonds. So the funny thing is that what you find is that people invest more in bonds, not because they make more money, but because they give you less, on average, losses. Right. So economists are always puzzled by, well, why are people investing more in bonds? But it seems like the reason they do this is that people are so hyped up about seeing losses in their portfolio that they ignore the fact that, in fact, stocks on average tend to do better than bonds.
So if I have a day in which someone takes away $20 from me and then someone else gives me $20 in a different aspect of my life, on the whole, I feel bad because I feel much more pain at losing the $20 than I feel joy at gaining the $20.
That's right. And in fact, this kind of phenomena can affect more than just your choices. It can also affect your preference for risk. So here's another example that Kahneman Tversky provided. So let's say, Josh, I give you $1,000. You have $1,000 now, and you get to have one more chance at getting some more money. You can either choose a 50-50 shot to win $1,000 more or get nothing, so a 50-50 shot at $1,000 or nothing, or I can just with certainty give you $500.
Oh, and then the others, and then if I change it around to say that you first give me the money and then you could
take
have
it
a 50-50 chance
yeah.
of me subtracting the money, then I'm much more willing to gamble.
Exactly. So what you find is that when people think they're dealing with losses, when they think they're going to lose money, they're much more willing to gamble because they're hoping for the possibility of getting no loss. Whereas when you think you're dealing in gains, you know, you're receiving money, you actually want to be safe, and so you get less risky when you're dealing in gains. But the crazy thing is it's only based on how I tell you the problem, like whether you think you have money now or whether you think you're losing it.
So if I want to make someone feel less risk-seeking, what I should do is try to frame everything in terms of gains.
That's
if I want them to be more risk-seeking, I should try to frame everything in terms of possible losses.
Exactly.
Okay, so far we've been talking about these very economic ways of framing these questions. That is to say, we've been talking about people making gambles between specific amounts of money. But of course, monkeys don't usually exchange money with each other. So how exactly were you able to get monkeys to engage in this kind of experiment?
Yeah, so we kind of had two choices. You know, we could either be very creative and come up with a way to ask about loss aversion and these kinds of phenomena, you know, in the absence of money, or we could just suck it up and teach the monkeys how to use something like money. And we actually mm-hmm. chose the latter approach.
So now you have these monkey financiers who are
exactly
busy yeah. exchanging money.
So the way we did it was we trained our monkeys that they could trade sort of tiny metal tokens with us for pieces of food. Mm-hmm. And you actually can train a monkey to do this pretty quickly. They quickly learn that the tokens seem to be exchanged with humans for food. But then the exciting thing is, having trained the monkeys this, now we could stick them into an experimental market. So basically the monkeys get up in the morning, they get a little wallet of tokens, and then they get to go into a market to buy their food from different experimenters. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing is, we can vary how much the monkeys are charged for different foods from different experimenters, you know, how much mm-hmm. the token buys them, you know, what kinds of foods we're offering, and so on. We can really set it up like an actual human market, which is great because, you know, we can ask, you know, what they know about the market, all these kind of cool economic questions, but we can also use this market to ask about these errors that we were just talking about, loss aversion and so on.
So were the monkeys, did they become corrupted by the market? Did they begin trying to cheat you out of your money?
It's a good question. The sad thing is that, in fact, in some cases they do. So they tend to, the surprising thing is they tend to, even though they don't really have much market experience, right? We just gave them mm-hmm. the tokens and tried to see what they know. They actually seem to treat the market in a lot of ways like humans do. So they're pretty savvy consumers. You know, if they have a choice between one experimenter who's offering a better deal than another experimenter, they'll tend to trade mm-hmm. more with the experimenter who's offering them the better deal. If we make an object or one of the foods go on sale, so one of the experimenters is kind of showing a sale, they'll end up switching and shopping more with the guy who's mm-hmm. selling apples, say, on sale than the other guy. And kind of so that they're smart, and beyond that, they do get a little corrupt, unfortunately. They tend to see the tokens as stores of value, which is pretty interesting, but that means that they're also kind of prone to trying to steal the tokens sometimes. You know, they will occasionally try to rip the experimenter off. So the way the trading works is the monkeys actually put the token physically into the experimenter's hand, but sometimes they'll do, you know, a little smooth thing where they try to sneak it out, you know, before the experimenter can actually close his hand. So the experimenter might pay the monkey even though he didn't actually get a token. So they're pretty, they get a little corrupt with the whole market.
Mm-hmm. So you explained earlier that humans, when they're involved in a market, show these irrational tendencies. Mm-hmm. For example, an irrational tendency to choose bonds over stocks because the joy that we get out of gains is less than the pain that we get out of losses.
Exactly.
So now, when you create a monkey market, do you find that the monkeys, as it were, also choose bonds over stocks, that they also show this kind of loss aversion?
Mm-hmm. In fact, we actually do. So this is, again, all work that is done with my graduate student, Venkat Lakshminarayanan, and an economist at Yale, Keith Chen. So what we mm-hmm. wanted to do was kind of give the monkeys this stock or bond question. And the way we did that was we gave the monkeys a choice between experimenters who seemed like they were giving losses versus an experimenter who seemed like they were giving gains. And the way we did that was to try to show the monkey that sometimes experimenters don't necessarily give what they're promised. So mm-hmm. the experimenter who gives a loss starts out by showing the monkey three pieces of food. So the monkey thinks, oh, I'm going to get three pieces of food when I pay him. But then when the monkey pays that experimenter, the monkey only gets two pieces of food. So it's pretty good the monkey gets two pieces, but you know, he thought he was going to get three. So that's the mm-hmm. loss guy. The gains guy is pretty similar, except that rather than start out with three pieces of food, this guy only starts out with one piece of food. So monkey thinks, oh, I'm just going to get one piece of food from this guy. But then when he pays the guy gives him an extra piece of food. So he gives them a, sort of a gain or a bonus for two pieces of food. So
each monkey is getting, each person is giving two pieces of food. But in one case, that two is framed as a gain. In another case, the two pieces of food is framed as a loss.
That's exactly right. So the question is, who does the monkey go towards? Well, what we find is mm-hmm. the monkeys avoid the guy who's giving the losses, and they trade more with the guy who's giving the gains.
Mm-hmm.
So then we want to see, well, is this because of that they, you know, do they like bonuses, or are they really avoiding losses? So to do that, we gave the monkeys a choice between one experimenter who always showed two pieces of apple, but then when the monkey paid him, the monkey only got one piece of apple, versus mm-hmm. a second guy who always showed one and gave one. So the only difference mm-hmm. between the two experimenters is that the first guy is always giving a loss and then the second guy gives what's promised. And what you find is that the monkeys show a reliable preference to avoid the guy who's giving them losses, even though, again, they're getting the same amount of food from this guy and then the other guy. So the cool thing is it seems like the monkeys actually share our sort of irrational avoiding of things that appear to be losses. Interestingly, you know, even in cases where they're getting the same amount of food from each of the two individuals.
So would there be any other way of explaining it? Say, not in terms of loss aversion, but in terms of trying to avoid being deceived, mm-hmm. or trying to avoid this character that, say, some actual agent is harming you in a particular way,
yeah.
trying to avoid coming off as a chump?
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to follow up on this right now. Actually, one of the studies mm-hmm. that we're starting right now is trying to look at whether or not the monkeys would perform similarly if it wasn't a human experimenter that was trading with them, but kind of an inanimate robot. So mm-hmm. is it worse to get losses from an experimenter who kind of intends to cheat you than it is to get losses from some inanimate robot? And you know, we don't know exactly yet, but an interesting thing is that few people have posed the question of where loss aversion comes from in the first place. But one reasonable way to think that loss aversion might have come about is because it's a really good mechanism for figuring out when you're getting less than you're supposed to. And, you know, perhaps over primate evolution, cases in which you're supposed to get less than, or when you might get less than you're supposed to, might happen in the context of social interactions. So loss aversion in some sense is qualitatively or mechanistically similar to some kind of cheater detection of kind of getting less than you're owed or getting less than you think you were going to get from someone in general. So
many of these original Kahneman Tversky experiments don't involve any kind of social exchange. But you're thinking the kind of underlying mechanism that we see in those experiments is actually due originally to a need to avoid being cheated. And then it was kind of generalized into cases in which you could say that you're, as it were, cheated by nature.
That's right. I mean, so this you know, it's hard to potentially test this phenomenon, but one way that we're hoping to is to actually look at how the monkeys treat these kinds of losses and gains in the context of some inanimate thing. And mm-hmm. you know, the prediction is, you know, they might distinguish, and it might be the case that humans just generalize these phenomena broadly. You know, so when you're cheated by a vending machine, you know, you mm-hmm. still have the kind of righteous rage about it. You know, you still get angry at the vending machine, even though, you know, it's a vending mm-hmm. machine. It doesn't really have an intention to cheat you, but, you know, the same kinds of processes might play out for us. And mm-hmm. sort of an open question is whether the same types of processes will play out for the monkeys, too.
You know, this actually seems to relate to some of the earlier work that you did before you began looking at these kind of questions,
mm-hmm.
where you showed that monkeys or chimpanzees can sort of understand that someone did something intentionally, but only in the context where you're trying to screw them.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to do something nice to them, it seems like monkeys are not able to understand that you're doing it on purpose.
That's right. Yeah, so this might be kind of a nice situation or a nice context in which you see this rich intentional understanding coming out, you know, mm-hmm. particularly because losses or getting less than you expected is so salient.
So if you show that this phenomenon that we see in humans, loss aversion, is also arising within monkeys, as the experiments seem to be indicating so far, then would that make you conclude that loss aversion, as we see it in humans, is actually just something built into us, not something that we learned, but a kind of dumb aspect of our thinking that we have innate?
Yeah, I mean, that's the hypothesis, or I guess the interpretation that we've been pushing. And it comes in conflict a little bit with, I think, the way a lot of economists think about these kinds of biases. So sort of more classical economists tend to think that, you know, you can probably get rid of these kind of phenomena if you just come up with the right incentives or the right mm-hmm. kind of public training program or something. You know, it's that people don't realize what they're doing is a bad idea. If you could sort of provide the right incentives, people could get over this loss aversion stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that we're seeing these same kinds of biases in the monkeys, you know, might suggest that these things are far more ingrained, like a far deeper part of our psychology than we might have thought about before. And it makes mm-hmm. the strong prediction that the kinds of incentives economists have classically brought up to get rid of some of these biases might not actually work. And mm-hmm. this is actually the kind of interpretation that's inspired a different set of behavioral economists to try to ask, well, you know, given that these biases might be, you know, built into some interesting extent, or at least hard for humans to overcome, can you use them as part of public policy campaigns to kind of get people to behave better or get people to behave more optimally.
So our campaign would be something like, don't be like a monkey.
Yeah.
Buy stocks.
Or like you were saying before, with the parking ticket situation is, you know, if you know people are going to react more strongly to losses than to gains, you know, set the system up so that people are penalized via losses as opposed to rewarded via gains, say.
Oh, now I understand. So you mean to just, instead of trying to make people be more rational, to capitalize on their irrationality in such a way as to make them do what turns out to be the right thing to do.
Exactly. And so people like Dick Thaler and Cass Sunstein and others are actually using this kind of logic to try to see if you can set up, you know, savings programs that work better for people, or, you know, diet programs that, you know, people are more likely to stick to, and all these things. It's really this idea of, you know, if you just take these biases seriously, maybe we can use them in people's favor rather than sort of making people fight against them.
Okay, so far we've been talking about two different ways in which the kind of dumb aspects of human beings, or the kind of silly aspects of the way we think and behave, can actually be seen as monkeys as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the two we've seen so far are cognitive dissonance and loss aversion. But what is next on the horizon? So now that you've done these two things, what are we going to be turning to in the future?
Well, there's sort of two things. One is first just trying to see, you know, well, what other kinds of biases are shared. So looking broadly, and maybe some of the ones that we see in humans might actually be unique to us. Along with a set of graduate students, we're starting to look at stereotyping and in-group out-group biasing, some of our misguided numerical estimates, things like anchoring and so on. So that's the first part, is, you know, what other biases are shared as well. But the second part, and I think the potentially the more exciting part, is actually following up on the biases that we already know about, using the tasks that we already have to ask how robust are these biases. And in particular, in the case of the market, you know, what are the other kinds of phenomena that can affect monkeys' choice behavior, you know, perhaps in a way that, you know, may or may not be a rational one. So next on the horizon for the monkey market is actually a set of monkey advertising studies to try to see if we can move their preferences around and move their choice behavior around through various advertisements. So
what products are you going to be advertising to the monkeys?
You know, it's sort of top secret right now, but we're actually starting a study where we're introducing the monkeys to Coke and Pepsi advertisements and trying to see whether or not they're going to buy more of a juice that they get out of Coke and Pepsi bottles. So we're not sure how this is all going to play out, but stay tuned.
So do you have a hypothesis? Do you think that they're going to be susceptible to these kind of advertisements in just the way that human beings are?
Well, there's two possibilities. I mean, one is that you know, the reason that humans respond to ads is a really high-level reason. You know, we, you know, have these rich beliefs about, you know, the fact that we're a Coke drinker, or rich beliefs about the kind of person we are, and ads play into those rich beliefs, and that's how they kind of affect our behavior. Alternatively, it could be that ads are, you know, very, very high cognitive. Like, what ads are really doing are providing more rich information about how you should act and what you should do, and, you know, prices and these kinds of things. Both of these interpretations are extremely high level and might not immediately be applied to monkeys. The alternative is just that ads are really just a boring form of, you know, conditioning. You know, it's the kind of thing that you sort of a stimulus response kind of thing. You know, if you associate Coca-Cola with, you know, attractive, you know, mating partners enough times, you know, you tend to like Coke more just because of its association with, say, attractive mating partners.
So you're going to have advertisements maybe with really hot monkeys next to a can of Coke?
That's exactly right. I mean, you should have seen the, you know, Barbados photo shoot, you know, for the advertisement. But that's the idea, is we just, you know, pit the objects in question that we want to advertise with things that the monkeys might like, either attractive mating partners or high-ranking individuals, you know, to kind of play on social status and so on, and then just try to see if it affects their preferences. And right now, you know, again, we're at the very, very early stages of this stuff, but the point is that it shows now that we have the methods to go after some of these biases, we can really use these methods to ask a whole broad array of questions to ask about human uniqueness and all these potentially weird domains like marketing and advertising and so on.
So, Lori, I'm really looking forward to seeing the monkey Coca-Cola ad. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, no problem. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.